As students around the country finish the school year at home, many are finding it takes discipline to stay on task.
You're going to have to be more responsible about your work. Can't rely on any authorities to tell you. You have to really take it into your own hands.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about home learning from the student's perspective. We'll also hear how the pandemic may change medical training and spend an academic minute learning to share the road. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Since schools started closing around the country, we've been speaking with educators and policymakers about the switch to online learning. But how are the students coping with the change in their routine? To find out, reporter and producer Sandra Averhart checked in with two of her young relatives who attend classes in the Escambia County School District in the Florida Panhandle. First, the high schooler.
So first, Escambia has their own website for their work. It's called Canvas.
This is soon-to-be 16-year-old Keandre, a 10th grader at Escambia High School. Sitting at the kitchen table, across from his 9-year-old sister Shemaya, he opens his Chromebook and shows me the Canvas dashboard that displays his courses for the semester.
We have everything set up so where we have our classes, courses, everything that we take, and you click on either one of them and just see what work is there. So for biology, you go to your assignments, and it's basically the same thing for every class.
On the screen is a series of colorful rectangular tiles representing classes that Keandre is taking. The required biology, a shade of green, is the first online course he comes to. There's also a vertical sidebar where he can access links to his courses, user groups, calendar, his message inbox, and help if he encounters a problem.
Good afternoon, Gators. It's Mr. Murphy.
In a video message posted as schools were gearing up for distance learning, Escambia principal Frank Murphy laid out what his students could expect over the next few weeks and offered assurance that their transition should be a smooth one based on what they've already been doing.
I'm confident that each of us will work through this virtual education platform, because quite frankly, you've been exposed to it through your Canvas accounts, through your Google Classrooms that your teachers use on a daily basis.
We do most of our work online. We rather use paper, but mostly over the break, we already had assignments for spring break, but now it's permanent now, so we really have to be on it.
For Keandre, who needed a charger for his Chromebook before he could get back to work, Friday was his first real day of virtual learning.
Today I worked on my driver's ed. We had to take a quiz on it. I got 100 on that. It was matching definitions with the words. And yeah, I got 100. Second, I did my honors too.
That's English honors too. Keandre is also taking geometry. Digital design is one of his electives.
This is Class Crafts. It's for digital design. And this is where we turn our work in on this. So in class, we'll come in and log in. We'll have a daily thing that we have to do. And we get XP for different types of things we do.
XP means extra points.
This is my avatar right here.
His choice for avatar is an armored, shield-wielding warrior. Rounding out his class schedule is a sign language course and basketball. before spring break and school closures to slow the spread of coronavirus, Keandre started and ended each day with the sport he loves. It was his first period class. Additionally, he spent many days after school at practices and games for the school's junior varsity team. The 2019-2020 season wrapped up just before state and federal officials got serious about COVID-19. He hopes to make varsity next year. For now, though, basketball is his backyard exercise and release at the end of each day, after his online assignments are complete. He knows that his academic success in these unprecedented times is really up to him.
You're going to have to be more responsible about your work and can't rely on, like, your mom or any authorities to tell you. You have to really take it into your own hands.
You think it's going to be okay? How do you think the next month or so is going to go?
I really can't say, but right now, I think everybody's just adjusting to it.
You think you'll be able to keep up pretty good?
Yeah, I will.
A plus, he says, is that students will have their coursework at their fingertips, with Canvas available as an app on their smartphones. Next time, we'll go from 10th grade to 3rd grade with Keandre's sister and my niece, Shamaya.
Little girl, you want to show me what you're doing?
Yeah.
Okay, come show me, tell you what you got.
And with that, 9-year-old Shamaya, a 3rd-grade student at Brentwood Elementary School, pulls a chair into place where her Chromebook sits on the kitchen table. Just minutes ago, she heard her brother, Keandre, describe his new world of virtual learning, so she jumps right in.
So I have already, and it's like a lot of stuff, and I have Google Classroom. So, like, every time when one of my teachers posts something, I can get it, and my teacher can text me on my computer.
Shamaya goes on to explain that they have meetings on Google Classroom, and it's also where she can access her assignments.
I have math, extra math. I got vocabulary, and my teacher, she posts a lot of stuff so we can do it.
And what is that, EPIC?
Yes, it's like an online reading program.
So what did you work on today?
I did some math. And we have this progress thingy where you get to get a lot of minutes and however many minutes you get.
Tracks how long you've been working?
Yeah. And like it gives me how many lessons I passed in a row.
At the time we spoke on Friday afternoon, Shamaya believed her teacher, Mrs. Stewart, had signed off on 10 completed lessons in a row.
Whatever you completed, it's going to get right here in what grade you got. And then up in here, I got an 86.
And what was that in?
Math.
Math. Okay, good. Yay.
Right now, Shamaya is showing off the program used for their weekly music class.
It's Quaver, and that's my personality. Sometimes you get to make your own music. So, like, you learn the same thing that you learn up in class when you're at school, but it's online.
The kids love it.
This is Shamaya's teacher, Jill Stewart.
A lot of times for indoor recess, you know, on bad weather days, I'm looking around and my kids are on Quaver playing.
Since the students have worked on this computer-based music program and others in school, Mrs. Stewart says she isn't worried about her kids' online learning curve. She's more concerned about getting them engaged on a school schedule.
After being out of school for, you know, 2.5 to 3 weeks, depending on the student, they're not back into the swing of things. And so that I'm finding a little challenging, getting all of my class back in so that I can meet with them 2 to 3 times a day.
Through Google Classroom, Mrs. Stewart began online meetings with her students last week. One student at the first meeting, then two. She expects to have all of her 20 students by this week. Now, during her Friday afternoon meeting during the first week of distance learning, she had a handful of students logged in and messaging. A lot.
Well, I cannot possibly read all these, but it's Tamaya, hey, Jamie and Ja'Kayla. Jamie's like, hey, and Ja'Kayla's, hey, y'all.
During the session, Mrs. Stewart tried to keep Shamaya and her other students focused as she discussed her class meeting and lesson plans and shared some of the fun programs and websites to include live zoo cams that she's assembled for them.
For your grades, I want to make sure that you're getting all your work done.
The teacher seemed to grab back their attention when she started to discuss how they'll earn their grades.
The way that your grade is, if you're getting 30 minutes every day in iReady Reading, your iReady Reading grade will be 100.
They complete 100% of their task. That's 100 that's going in the grade book for that week for that specific task. And so my goal is that this will be the best report card they've seen so far in their life.
According to Mrs. Stewart, a realistic commitment from the third graders is about 3 hours a day of online learning. And she says the iReady program allows the kids to progress at their own pace. Now, during their Friday meeting, she pledged to do her part by being available to answer their questions and provide free tutoring services if needed. Then she signed off.
Big hugs. Give me some big hugs. Two fists like this. Squeeze them tight. Come on, Amara. Aiden. Ooh, that's a good one. Good,
Jemiah. I kind of miss talking to my friends. And I definitely miss when all the teachers be talking to me up in the hallway and all that stuff.
Again, my 9-year-old niece, Jemiah, weighing in on her new school normal, at least for now.
I really do miss my teacher. It's so hard.
And that report was from Sandra Averhart from WUWF Radio at the University of West Florida. Still to come, will the coronavirus pandemic change the way medical professionals are trained? That conversation is next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Working in the middle of a pandemic can showcase the best of the American medical system. It can also shine a light on things that can be improved and should be changed. Here to talk about some possible changes is Dr. Timothy Hoff, a professor of management, healthcare systems, and health policy at the DeMoor McKim School of Business and School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University in Boston. We started by talking about the immediate lessons learned from the pandemic.
If you're from the medical community, it's not just having clinical knowledge and it's not just being the smartest doctor in the room that counts in a situation like this. I mean, you need a whole additional set of skills, crisis management, the ability to work fast, the ability to sort of make decisions in split second time, even quicker than you probably might in terms of something more normally you might do on a clinical level. And then just the sheer emotional content of what's being thrown at you, the psychology of having to deal with tens and hundreds of sick patients. If you're working in, you know, a hospital in New York City, it's got to be overwhelming. And I think there's ways you can better prepare, particularly doctors, for these kinds of events. But there's no way until you truly go through it as a physician, for example, that you can really know what it's about.
I'm sure somewhere there are smart heads of medical departments at universities saying, we've got to rewrite everything. Once this clears, what do you think med schools are going to start to focus on in the very most basic levels?
Well, you know, as we know, medical schools are really slow to change anything. They've sort of had the same model for decades in the United States, for a century, if you really go back all the way to the Flexner Report and the early days. But hopefully, I mean, you know, you look at the first 2 years of medical school, which traditionally is all about basically sitting in a classroom and learning, you know, basic science skills and memorizing a ton of science facts. And then at the end of the second year, you take this test, you know, this big multiple choice test. I mean, I think some of that hopefully is going to be looked at, and people are going to ask, you know, how do we make the early part of training to be a doctor more aligned with the realities of some of the public health crises and some of these situations that may unfortunately become more prevalent. So, you know, what does that mean? That means introducing potentially other topics besides basic science into the curriculum, public health concepts, public health training, basic understandings of things like epidemiology and population health to better understand these big public health emergencies that happen. The COVID pandemic being obviously the biggest example we've had of one. There's going to need to really, I think, be an examination of how young medical students train, who they train with, right? It's still pretty much a medical student sitting in a classroom with other medical students, but increasingly moving more towards interprofessional training, having medical students training alongside nursing students, training alongside nurse practitioner students, for example, early on to develop more of a team mentality and to understand really how to deliver care within a team, because that's what you're seeing as a really important thing happening. For example, in these hospitals that are being overwhelmed right now, the ability to work together and to switch off roles to some extent. You know, doctors are doing things that nurses normally do because everybody has to pitch in. And then I think thinking about exposing some of our younger medical students during training, giving them more immersion in psychology, in social psychology, in understanding human thoughts and human emotions, and really learning more how to deal with that, both in terms of their patients and also in terms of themselves, right? Because we know in medical school, there's a lot of burnout. There's a lot of psychological distress that happens to people, the students taking it. And we need to be giving them even more exposure to things like building resilience for themselves and building the emotional component of what they're going to be doing. Because if we don't do that, we're producing doctors that when these crises hit may have to work harder to not get burned out and not get sort of emotionally overwhelmed by the situation.
Do you think that students, med students coming up now, or med students who are just about to take on the school and are living through this, are going to start demanding different things from their school, from their education?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you're already reading a lot. You know, I've read a lot of stories from young doctors and from older doctors who are sort of working at these ground zeros in New York City and elsewhere, and sort of what they've had to go through and what their training prepared them for and what it didn't. And I think having lived through this, a lot of them, they will be some of the change agents in terms of pushing, you know, not only medical schools, but also residency programs, the apprenticeship model. Well, once a student graduates from medical school and goes into residency programs, which are normally hospital-based, hopefully there'll be change agents that can push for, you know, hey, what do medical residents, regardless of what they're training to do, being a neurologist or being an internist, what do they need more exposure to in the hospital setting and need to learn more? So I certainly hope there'll be change agents. I also think they're going to maybe, you know, this is another issue, but it's related, is there may be a greater realization of how physicians need to band together more and need to band together more with other healthcare workers like nurses to sort of, even at a younger career stage, be able to collectively advocate for better treatment and better conditions, right? Because we see this issue of a shortage of personal protective equipment and just some of the things we've asked our doctors and nurses and health professionals to, the conditions we've asked them to work in during this crisis, and it's just not acceptable. And so I hope that coming out of this, there'll be more of an appreciation among doctors, young nurses, to actually collectively come together and demand from the organizations they work for, hey, you know, we're all for trying to do this kind of work and help in times of crisis, but we need to be fully prepared and we need to be given the resources we need.
We're seeing now how so many people in rural communities are kind of out on an island without any doctors nearby. Is virtual and telehealth going to be more a part of training?
Yes, absolutely, and it should be. I haven't always myself been the biggest fan of introducing that kind of virtual care too quickly into patient care, because I think you lose something without the interpersonal face-to-face human element in a lot of care delivery, particularly things like mental health care and primary care, chronic disease management. But at this point, you have doctor's offices closed all around the country. You have hospitals not doing elective surgeries. you're going to have a huge backlog of care that needs to be delivered once things start to open up again. And so medical students, medical residents, those in the training cycle right now should really, and moving forward, future students, this has to become now a regular part of their training. I think it's here to stay. I think this represents a tipping point for bringing telehealth more into medicine, particularly for primary care. And I think there's areas like many rural areas across the country, for example, that already don't have any kind of access to good care. They don't have doctors nearby. And so this is going to deliver to them, hopefully, better care over time. But it's not... The training system won't be able to absorb this overnight. But, you know, there's no doubt, like, medical students now should be doing rotations in their third and fourth year, right? They traditionally do clinical rotations where they go around to different parts of the hospital and different specialties. There should be a telehealth rotation now for every medical student. There should be big doses of telehealth medicine put into every residency program, regardless of your specialty. And I think you're probably going to see that moving forward. It's just a question of how quickly it will happen.
After a national crisis, people take action. We saw that after 9/11. So many people volunteered to go into the military. Do you think after this, and this is purely speculation at this point, that you're going to see a wave of people going into the medical field, either doctors or nurses?
That's a great question. I mean, if you think about it from the perspective of, like, what happens with sort of military recruitment in times when there's some sort of strife or event, you know, and you see this bump in people enrolling or enlisting, whether it's the National Guard or the military. I think you could see the same thing here, potentially. You could see a real uptick, at least temporarily, in high school students that want to go to college and study pre-med. You're going to, you know, you may see an uptick in college students who decide becoming a doctor or not, you know, not even a doctor, maybe a nurse practitioner or a nurse or a physician assistant. That this is something that not only has a bigger importance now, and everybody can see it because of the pandemic, but also is a sort of noble thing to do and to sort of commit to. So I do think you'll probably see a bump in medical school admissions and nursing school admissions. You know, how long that lasts is an interesting question. I mean, I think you also may see on the other end, you know, young people who say, you know, being a doctor looks really difficult. And I see how difficult it looks now with how doctors have had to deal with the COVID pandemic and doctors working for hospitals. And so maybe there may also be some young people that decide, you know what, this is incredibly challenging and difficult. And I see that the challenges these people faced when they were trying to do this work. And so would that deter some young people from actually taking the plunge? I don't know. But I do think we'll see, you know, initially maybe this rise in sort of medicine and nursing in these professions, as these are really desirable if you want to help society and make a difference.
Looking at it from the other end, there's probably a lot of doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals right now going, oh my God, I got to get out of this. I am totally burnt out.
Yeah, there's different groups of doctors, right, that will be experiencing different things based on what they had to deal with during this crisis. So for the, you know, for doctors that were working in the hospital and working in hot spots around the country where there was a rise in cases quickly and they, you know, everybody had to work in an intensive care and a critical care mode, this is going to be, you're going to see more behavioral health issues in this population, potentially people dealing with, you know, maybe some post-traumatic stress from it all, burnout. And these were workers, these were doctors that are already sort of suffering from high levels of burnout in their job. So there's that group, the ones that have really been dealing with the sick patients who've been coming at them in waves. And then there's, you know, the group of doctors that are out in the community, primary care doctors, maybe surgeons who have their own practices out in the community, specialists. And the trauma they're going through is, you know, they've had to close their offices. They've had to essentially sever their relationships with their patients temporarily, right, to stop the spread of the illness, and also because they just have not been able to conduct business as usual. And so they're also going to go through a withdrawal. And when things kick back up again, and everybody floods back into the system needing sort of the care they needed to be getting during these months when these offices were closed, the potential for being overwhelmed, heavy workloads, and again, more burnout on the part of those kinds of doctors, I think you're going to see a lag. I think you're going to see, you know, that group experience more of these negative psychological states a little bit further down the road. So we need to make sure we have enough supports available for doctors and nurses to be able to get them through what's going to be, I think, a rough year or two in the short term.
Dr. Timothy Hoff is a professor of management, healthcare systems, and health policy in the Nemours McKim School of Business and School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University in Boston. Well, if nothing else, the coronavirus pandemic is keeping a lot of people off the road. But when the cars return, can't we all just get along? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can't we all just get along on the roads? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Monica Mendez, associate professor of civil and urban engineering at NYU Abu Dhabi, looks into the best way to move people around a city.
The way to get around some cities is rapidly changing. Major arterials are being closed to private cars in favor of buses. Cities are adding dozens of miles of protected bike lanes. How do cities arrive at decisions like these? Exactly how much of the limited road space should each mode, cars, buses, bikes, pedestrians get? This is a sensitive topic, as benefits to one transportation mode typically come at the expense of the other ones. Studies on the efficiency trade-off between different modes are limited, in part because the interactions across modes can be rather complex. For example, common wisdom says buses are more efficient than cars at transporting people, but that's not the whole story. Buses are larger, slower, and stop more frequently. As a result, they can be very disruptive to the overall traffic, ultimately lowering the throughput of a city in terms of how many vehicles per hour it can handle. This picture changes completely if we were to focus on the number of passengers per hour instead, as buses can carry significantly more passengers than cars. New monitoring and modeling tools now allow us to quantify these trade-offs, both in terms of vehicles and in terms of passengers. This is crucial for a better understanding of the advantages and disadvantages associated with each of the transportation modes from a holistic perspective, and it helps cities come to good decisions about how to share their roads more efficiently. The need for this sort of decisions is unlikely to go away soon. It is almost as old as cities themselves. Even before cars, pedestrians and horse-drawn carriages were competing for the available road space. As cities continue to evolve, we're going to have to keep adjusting the balance of roads so that we can share them in a way that makes the most sense for everyone, maximizing the overall people mobility.
That was Monica Mendez of NYU Abu Dhabi. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.